In 2011, author and speaker William Buhlmann received unexpected news that would set him on a course to further investigate the subtle but multiple realms of the afterlife. Having amassed over 40 years in out-of-body research, William felt there was more to know and more to experience personally while in the OBE state. His findings have now culminated in a most fascinating new book called Adventures in the Afterlife. Today, we speak to William about his own journey and that of the fictional character he created for his book, both of which takes the reader on an adventure that's sure to ignite the curiosity of those interested in knowing what lies beyond what we call physical death. William, I was so pleasantly surprised when I opened your new book, Adventures in the Afterlife. And I discovered that your story was based on the afterlife adventures of a fictional character named Frank Brooks, no relation to Alexis Brooks. The impetus for your writing this book was based on your own real-life adventure, as I understand it. Maybe you could share with the audience a little bit about how you decided to write this book.
Well, back in 2011, March, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer of the lymph nodes and tonsils. And I, as everyone can imagine, you know, you go through quite the drama associated with it. And I went through traditional treatment, and I also had a lot of non-traditional treatments. And during that course of especially the seven, 8 months that I was going through the surgery and the radiation, I had a lot of lucid dreams and out-of-body experiences that I guess because of my interest started to turn to the subject of, you know, what happens when we die. I started to have a lot of inner experiences, let's call them, related to the entire concept of the afterlife. And they were not a linear way. They were just often just non-related, it seemed like at the moment, experiences. So I just began to journal, like I always do. I journaled all my experiences, and I realized that this could make a fascinating story about the afterlife and what I did. So the book wouldn't be a me book. I created a fictional character, Frank Brooks, and I thought the book would have more impact, to be quite frank, if the main character died. So on page 11, I have Frank dies, and he enters he's a traditional type believer, and he enters another reality at what he thinks is heaven. Mm-hmm. And what I tried to do to the best of my ability, I detailed a progression of consciousness, his growth, his journey of consciousness after death, and what one person potentially experienced after his initial death and this initiation, let's say, into this first heaven, and then his continuing growth beyond that heaven, because he realizes there are other realities, which, of course, I've been writing about for 25 years, that we're in a multidimensional universe. And, of course, that continues after death. So it's only logical that we would have choices we could make after death. And what I tried to do is portray that to the best of my ability, this journey of consciousness, this transition of consciousness that occurred after death and all the potential that is available to us. Mm-hmm. That we're not locked into one reality. We have the ability to become explorers and actually experience these many, many dimensional realities. And the book is about his journey of consciousness through many different, let's just call them, levels of reality.
Right, right. I want to get into that. You're really getting into it quite quickly. I have some questions. I think you probably answered some of them already. But again, getting back to the format of the book, you know what it reminded me of, William, is the book by Richard Matheson, What Dreams May Come, probably one of my favorite books. Did you get any of the inspiration for the tone that this fictional character had from something like that? Are you familiar with that book?
You know, I've never read that book. I saw the movie, but yeah, I've never read his book, so no, I didn't get anything from that.
That's very interesting because it has such a similar tone. You should certainly read it. I think you'd be pleasantly surprised in you know, how the character, I can't recall, of course, it was played by Robin Williams in the movie, Chris, I think his name was, is speaking from the afterlife and sort of narrating to the reader what the experiences he's having and his family are. Very interesting.
In first person?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I did not know.
It's fascinating. And so that's why I say when I opened the book and I saw that this was sort of the format in which you were writing, and I was just thrilled because it really draws you in immediately. Very, very much so. So, you know, I want you to elaborate a little bit on Frank's progression through the non-physical realms. You discover that the adventure certainly doesn't end when we leave the physical world. It continues, right? We think of an adventure as living through life, and I guess so many people have different beliefs about what the afterlife is, that it's one place that you end up and you don't go any further. I don't know, but you show this absolute spectrum of consciousness. I want you to get into that a little bit more. I mean, when you look at the levels of consciousness that we're most, I suppose, commonly familiar with, that being first the physical, then the astral, of course, there's the lower, mid, maybe upper astral, mental, and then causal plane. Could we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. That was the idea, really. The main idea I wanted to express was the fact that not only does life go on, but our education as consciousness or soul continues in a very robust manner. A lot of people have this feeling like, oh, it's over. I die and then I end up in this place forever, which of course is not the truth at all. It's just as life is full of experiences and learning in the physical world through personal experiences, the same continues after death. It's just that the diversity and nature of the experiences become much wider, of course. There's more options available to people. And what I wanted to express was the fact that there are important choices that we make after death, not just, in other words, we don't have to accept what we initially experience as a consensus reality when we first make the transition of death, and that there's many, many millions of realities actually available to us, and I call them consensus realities, and they're all, it's like a radio dial where there's many frequencies, and you can tune into different frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to, and what I tried to portray, was the fact of his journey of consciousness beyond his first consensus reality, and then his, let's just say, education as consciousness, where he moves into a training ground, let's call it, for soul or consciousness, and he's actually trained to move, to explore his potential as soul, to expand beyond even its humanoid form, to expand his abilities to move, to explore the other dimensions that are available with us right now, but most people are locked into one. It's very similar to the physical world in a way. Most people don't realize in the physical world that they have the ability to have conscious out-of-body experiences and move into another dimensional reality.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, most humans don't know that, or they don't accept it as a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the same applies in the afterlife. Many people who have died, and I found this to be the case, do the same exact thing they do in the physical world. They accept what they're given. They don't explore beyond that reality, just like people do in the physical world. So it's not the dramatic change that people would think.
Right.
And they lock themselves into another reality. Yes, it's more pleasant in the physical world. There's no death, there's no disease, there's no wars. It's a much more pleasant, beautiful surroundings often, but it's still just it's like a golden box that people place themselves within.
Mm-hmm.
And what the main character does in this story, which is quite exciting, is that he continues his journey of more and more aware of his potential to explore other realities, and he becomes more aware of his true self. Mm-hmm. That he's a multidimensional being.
Yeah, he certainly is. Well, you know, it's interesting. I really want to stay on something a little bit that might be considered somewhat controversial, and that is the first environment that he experienced after his passing, and that was, I guess you could call it a thought-created or belief-based environment of a heaven that was very much akin to what he was taught, being, I would imagine, a pretty religious person. I found it interesting how he found himself in this environment. He met his mother there, and I suppose some others that he knew in life. And once he, but there was something that was not quite right to him, and he decided to question and was essentially scolded for questioning, you know, the environment and you know, questioning some of the teachings. Why him? Why was he the one, you think, out of all of the people around him in this thought-created heaven? What made him different, you think?
I think it was because he was just a little more open-minded to his potential. I mean, he started to just simply ask the important questions. Like he started out asking questions like, well, if I'm in heaven, where is Jesus?
Right.
I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but my God, isn't it? He in the book, he states, essentially, I was told that by my pastor that I was going to meet the angels, and he had this, let's just say, concept of reality that he was going to be reunited with Jesus, and suddenly he starts to realize after a while that, you know, Jesus isn't here. The angel, there's no angels here. Yes, it's very, very beautiful and pleasant, but this is not exactly, and it starts to dawn on him. It's almost like, in a way, like the Matrix is waking up to the fact that he's in a thought-created reality that's not really what he expected, and he starts to, he's a very curious guy, and he starts to question the nature of the very reality he stands within, and that starts to open up doors for him, and he begins to have his own inner experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I started reading that, and again, I knew where you were going, William. You and I have talked many times, and we've shared similar philosophies, so as we started to learn about shortly after Frank's passing, him being in this thought-created heaven, I said, I know where William's going with this. This concept of thought-created realities based on beliefs that were sustained in life is not necessarily new, particularly in metaphysical circles. You and I are both familiar with the Seth material by Jane Roberts, and I remember the first Seth book that I read was Seth Speaks, and where he goes into this very same concept of beliefs that are carried and held with conviction in life will ultimately invariably be the environment that we're most likely to find ourselves in the afterlife, at least initially. It may take thousands of earth years to progress past that, maybe more. But Seth almost describes that, or the reasoning for that, as almost a comfort level. So it's not too much of a shock to go from the physical and be catapulted directly to the causal, let's say. You know what I mean? Very, very interesting.
Yes. Well, one thing I've learned from I've had out-of-body experiences for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that, and a lot of this is based on my own experiences, and the first thing I learned is that we are, when we leave our bodies, we enter a thought-responsive dimensional reality.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have a difficult time conceiving of this, but it's actually quite logical. It's a less dense. The less dense the environment, the more that thought can mold that reality in a faster and faster way. So the reason that the physical world seems so stable to us is only the only reason is because it's so dense and it's slow to react to matter. But when you begin to examine it, you realize that everything in matter is a result of thought, because a thought is the precursor to everything that's matter. Whether it's a building or any a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a slow process. But as we move inward through our out-of-body, near-death experiences into this afterlife journey, things become more subtle. The realities are more subtle. The environments are more subtle, and they respond faster. And that is what all of these realities, Frank's first heavenly reality is a consensus reality of collective thought for that group of individuals who have all agreed that this is what they feel reality should be. And this is what creates reality. Not only what's weird for many people to conceive of is that that the same applies to the physical world.
Yes.
Cities, mm-hmm. countries, they're all a consensus belief system. I mean, that's what makes Thailand different than New York City. Or, you know, it's this group beliefs.
Right. That's powerful. Well, you talk about the OBE, the out-of-body experiences, as a way to move into some of these less dense realms, and where thought, of course, is more responsive and more immediate and forming around you as reality. What I found interesting in the book is during Frank's journeys, he was having repeated out-of-body experiences as he would progress into the next phase or the next reality. Maybe you could explain that. That could be kind of confusing to people that are hearing it, but I think what you're getting is that each progression prior to that, there's still some sort of a body that exists,
yes.
an ethereal body or a subtle body, and they were getting subtler and subtler, but he would, just prior to moving into the next level, he would have an out-of-body experience. Talk
yes.
about that a little bit.
That's a good question, and that is, I know that's going to be a little bit confusing to people that are not familiar with the concept of a multidimensional universe and our multidimensional nature, but it's actually quite common sense. We are multidimensional. When we die, we shift our consciousness into our next energy body, and then we experience what we call as heaven. It's just another dimension of reality. That is our astral body, let's call it. That's been the conventional term. What most people don't really seem to, actually it's quite exciting, but it's the idea that, yes, but then there's another energy body that's less dense, which some people, like you, call it the causal. Many people have different terms for it. And then there's a mental energy body.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, and some people say there's an unconscious, and then there's a then soul. The point is there's multiple energy bodies, and we're all part of this. Humans are much more complex than just body, mind, and spirit. That's
yes.
one thing I know from 40 years of OBEs.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is much more multidimensional than just, you know, heaven, hell, and matter. Everything is much more, a little more involved. And so it only makes sense that an individual, if he wanted to explore inward from the astral, he would have to experience his next less dense energy body. And if we could call it the causal body. And that's what exactly happens in the book. He has what he terms, because that's how he views it, as an out-of-body experience, even though he has died, because he's shifting his consciousness from his astral body to his causal body.
Mm-hmm.
And then experiencing that level, that vibrational level of reality. And that's exactly what happens in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I was following you. I kind of, because, you know, we've both, again, explored these concepts in this way, so I knew where you were going. I knew what was happening, but I knew that the reader would find that very interesting, maybe a little confusing, but if you're really paying attention, you can see what's happening, that it's a constant thrust forward out of an old, slightly more dense to a slightly less dense, and I suppose that could go on forever, beyond the causal. I don't know that there's any term to describe that, but you know, getting back to the earth plane, there was a scene, I guess you could say, where Frank is being shown by his guide Remy, who I want to talk a little bit about later, and they're all of a sudden they're in a couple's bedroom and they're watching the couple and dog asleep on the bed, but they're not only seeing the physical body, in fact, what they're seeing more clearly is those, that subtle body, while they were dreaming, including the animal, including the dogs.
Yes.
I found that interesting. You know, the dreamscape seems to be a conduit for these subtle realms. Would it be fair to say that when we dream all the time, that we're out of body?
I feel we are. Matter of fact, myself and others have observed people during sleep, and what we have observed and is that people energetically, consciously, they slightly separate. Just to be clear, I don't mean everybody's floating up at the ceiling. They're just out of phase with their body. Sleep is a process of moving out of phase with your physical body and recharging that energy body.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and but science doesn't realize this because they're so fixated on the physical outer world that that's all they know is that there's REM periods that occur. But let's face it, there's no videos of dreams. People
yeah.
don't know. People, we have no physical evidence that dreams are even real, but yet we have a consensus that, yes, they exist because we all dream.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that, yeah, these states are very subtle states, and everybody moves into them at night. Unfortunately, most people, unless you're trained, remain pretty much unconscious in this other state. That's why there's so many systems now that have become popular, like Tibetan dream yoga. There's actual systems where people begin to train themselves to become more lucid or aware in this state, which is an altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I feel that everyone moves slightly out of phase with their body during sleep.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just occurred to me when you said, when you talked about Tibetan dream yoga and training yourself to be more lucid in the dream state, I would imagine, you know, as you've described, working on self-initiating OBEs, that there's certain commands that you can use, like awareness now, or, you know, conscious now, you know, to trigger a lucidity. I don't know. I'm just wondering if you could, in the lucid dream state, might you use these same terms, awareness now?
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, in my workshop, that's one of the things, I do a six-day workshop at the Monroe Institute, and that's one of the things I teach, is for us to condition ourselves, to train ourselves through programming, because that's what we have to do. We have to reprogram ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in that process, you ask yourself, when in a dream, am I dreaming? You begin to question the very nature of your reality in all states, because that is the only way you're ever going to begin to awaken in that state, because life continues. People think, you know, when they're asleep, nothing's happening. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of activity while we're asleep.
Right.
Unfortunately, we as a culture and as a Western culture and society have not been trained to be aware in this one third of our lives, where some other places may be more so. And it's a matter of reconditioning yourself to become more aware so you can take advantage of this altered state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting. This is exciting work because it opens up a whole new realm of exploration for everyone.
It certainly
does. Become the explorers.
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. And it's our choice to do so at any point. I think you're absolutely right. Discovery is in our hands, always has been.
Yes.
We're jumping around so much because it's just so, you know, your book is so meaty with concepts that it's tempting to just go down that rabbit hole. But I want to bring us back a little bit. I want to go back in time a little bit and cover a couple of things about Frank's transition. You talk about deathbed visitors or bedside visitors. This is something that is well known to a lot of people. And it usually, you know, you hear about Aunt Sue, just before she passed, she saw loved ones from spirit at the bedside. I've heard this more times than a few. And I believe there's a reference to that in the book as Frank is making his transition into the first phase of the afterlife. What's happening there in your estimation, William? You know, would it be fair to say that we are starting to, you know, as we're beginning to transition and pass over, are we glimpsing these passed on individuals through astral eyes, even though we're still alive?
Yes, that's exactly how I look at it. We are beginning to make the transition, which is normal. By the way, my wife is a hospice worker.
Is she?
And she's heard a lot of these kinds of stories. Matter of fact, I heard one just yesterday. She's at the hospice right now. And this is a common phenomenon. People, as they make the transition, remember, death is a transition. It's not the end. It's a transition of consciousness. Let's start from there.
Yes.
And so we're making this shift of consciousness from the physical to the non-physical. No one would argue with that. So what's happening is, and it's only natural, it's nature's way of becoming comfortable with the next reality you're about to enter. People begin to make that shift from their physical state of consciousness, and they begin to activate, let's say, their astral body. And I'm just using our energy body. I usually use that term.
Mm-hmm.
And they're beginning to see through their astral eyes. They're beginning to connect with their astral senses so they can begin to see loved ones. Remember, people forget that these dimensions are not up there or down there. They're right here with us. They're just out of phase. They're actually, everything is here now.
Mm-hmm.
The afterlife is not someplace else, and this people have a difficult time with this. It's just in less dense,
yes,
more energetic, higher. Let's call it a higher frequency environment. But it's right here next to us, with us. There's no separation at all, except for vibrationally.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they begin to essentially, people that are dying are tuning in to this other dimension, which is already there, so they begin to see their loved ones who are gathered for the transition. And this is so common. This is reported by millions and millions.
Very common. Very.
Oh, my goodness. There's so many books written about this.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the most common phenomena on the planet. It's expected. People begin to have communication with loved ones who are waiting for them. Literally, they're waiting for the transition to greet them.
Yeah.
And they actually talk to them.
Absolutely.
And that it's amazing, but it's an actual natural transfer of consciousness. And it's the most normal thing you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Most people listening to this, William, are going to have heard an experience or more of their own family members speaking of the same thing. I can think of a handful of my own friends and family members that have told me stories like this. I never cease to be amazed at why we have such evidence, and as far as I'm concerned, proof that this is what's going on here, that it's a transfer of consciousness, and yet society at large still seems to refuse to acknowledge that when we're experiencing these things ourselves.
I know, and millions of people.
Millions of people.
Yeah, we're talking about, it's such a normal thing. Anybody that works in hospice realizes that this is just a normal transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And normal events. And they even gauge them about how often they're happening. I know hospice workers that can tell the moment of transition within a pretty accurate by the amount of contact they're having. The more contact, generally speaking, the closer they are to what we would perceive as dying.
Yeah. Can I share a story with you that will illustrate exactly what you're saying, and it has to do with the passing of my father. I don't know that I've told this on the show before, but if I have audience bear with me, I'm going to tell it again. My father passed about 10 years or so ago right here in our family home, and at his request. And we had hospice, a lovely hospice worker come over to the house in the last days to be with him, administer whatever medicines he needed, etc. And I recall going downstairs where my father was and the hospice worker. And, you know, just prior to his passing, I was in a very sort of emotionally wrought state, obviously. But I found myself being strangely, almost giddy. It's difficult to explain. I was very energetic for some reason. I don't know. Maybe I didn't want to face what was going on and I was trying to preoccupy myself. So I'm talking to the hospice worker, and I'll never forget, my dad was in his bed behind us, and I was showing her his book collection. He had an incredible book collection about the very things that we're talking about. He was very much a soul searcher. And I'm showing her these books. Keep in mind, my father is behind us, so we can neither one of us can see him. In mid-sentence, William, as I'm pointing out a book or two to her on the shelf, she looked at me, and she motioned for me to be quiet. She put her finger over her mouth, and she then turned and she pointed to my father. And then she signaled, she said, "Come here." And we walked over to him, and she said, "Watch." And within 3 seconds, he took his last breath. So your point is well taken. These hospice workers feel they have conditioned themselves to be sensitized to that transition. She knew exactly when it was going to happen, even when she had her back to him.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's. My wife says there's a high energy emanation during transition.
Yeah.
That's what she calls it.
I think that's...
It's very, she gets chills. I mean, she said you feel it. It's like an electrical charge almost, for lack of a better word. I mean, that's not a good way to describe it. But I think people get the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yes, it's amazing. It is amazing. But it's a transfer of consciousness, and it's a shame that so many people today approach this, and this is what I tried to get across in the second part of the book, we need a more enlightened way to handle this transition, so we're not approaching it in a fear-based manner. So many people, like my father, he was terrified. This is a guy that fought in World War II and killed people, but yet he was terrified at death.
Sure. Well, most
and
people
that's so sad.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, this is like a John Wayne kind of guy.
Right.
And because our society is so in denial that people don't even like to talk about the subject. So in the second part of the book, what I tried to include is, I call it enlightened transition. At least give us a little more guidance on what we can do to prepare ourselves for this transitional phase. So that we can approach it with... In a more positive mindset, instead of just being fearful and unknowing and uncertain, you know, all these doubts that people have.
Right.
Approach it in a more positive mindset, like they teach in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and other manuals that have been around for a while.
Well,
I think that's so important in today's world.
And that it certainly is. And in fact, toward the back of the book, you do have some excellent guided meditations and other suggestions for people wanting to progress spiritually while they're here on this planet, in order to help them progress once they're in the afterlife. But the one I found particularly critical is how you talk about assisting loved ones, as well as assisting ourselves with the dying process. And, you know, a mutual colleague of ours, mutual acquaintance, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, calls this conscious dying. And I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit. You know, we are so habituated toward the process of death being a very secluded, alone, and excruciating process. Certainly, we're thinking as we're watching our loved ones, there's nothing we can do except cry. But no, it looks like there's a lot more we can do, especially some of the things that are highlighted in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where the monks are literally surrounding the dying person and chanting. Talk about that a little bit. I think that's fascinating, conscious dying.
Well, I feel this is so important today. Because you're absolutely right. People think there's no help available to that. In other words, when a loved one dies, what do most people do? They basically relinquish everything and hand over to a professional organization, hospital or hospice, and they feel like they have nothing they can add or help or do anything with. And nothing could be further from the truth. We have the ability to assist. For instance, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, for over 1,000 years, they talked about the concept of just surrounding your loved ones and providing positive support. Like in their context, it was go to the clear light of the void, which means go beyond form-based realities. But we could do the same thing. We could sit next to our loved one and say, you know, go to your spiritual source or essence, whatever terms that resonate with you. We can provide a mental environment, let's say, that a much more positive. Because let's face it, most people in modern America, they're surrounded by strangers.
That's right.
It's and that's not the way it's been for the entire history of humanity. This is a new development just in the last really 80 years.
Right.
People used to be around loved ones. Now it's a different scenario, and I think it's important that we have the ability to provide some kind of mental assistance to our loved ones, and I provide even a script for it in the book.
You do.
Where you can, hey, try this. Use your own terms, whatever resonates with you, but send them positive energy. Surround them in positive, loving energy. Don't just walk away and leave them around a bunch of strangers. Try to provide some mental and emotional energy, positive energy assistance. And I, of course, go into great detail on this, but I think that gets across the concept.
Absolutely. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, my gosh, you know, we were talking a moment ago about the conditions that one might meet in the afterlife being initially residue from either a lifelong belief system or even those last few moments. If those last few moments were covered in grief, crying loved ones, sometimes screaming, who knows, it can be a very, very tumultuous situation. I have to imagine that the immediate aftermath when that person is in the afterlife is going to reflect that same energy. So what you're saying is it becomes absolutely critical for not just an option, but maybe mandatory for the loved ones to be around the dying person with calming feelings and sending calming energy and whatever euphemisms you want to use.
Yes, I think it's essential. And this is what is taught in many cultures. It's not a new concept. It's just been kind of lost in the modern era where people die in institutions now.
Mm.
And it's become very unpersonal on every level. And people need, I think, that kind of emotional, loving assistance, especially from those that are their loved ones.
Right.
We can't just depend on the medical community to do everything.
Yeah. And yet, as we talk about hospice workers, your wife being one of them, they are, so many of them are literally godsend.
They do all they can.
Yeah.
But they're only there. Most of them are part-time.
Right.
My wife is part-time. They're only there for 20 hours a week, and they're only generally there during the day.
Right.
So they can only do so much. So I think it's good that it's nice when you see occasionally that the families step up and they try to do a little more than they, let's just say, that's been done in the last 30 years especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Families have, I'm feeling now, so much of a critical role, not just in the transition, but after that transition, months after, years after. You talk about, you make a strong point, both in the fiction part of your book and in part two, which is sort of a follow-on to the first section, about the ramifications of people who hold on to their loved ones through grief, and that can really hold them back from progressing. The loved one progressing in spirit. I think this is incredibly important information. I actually covered this a little bit in an article I wrote many years ago called A Manual for Grief, You Write the Guidelines. Again, something that needs to be, I mean, it's difficult when you've lost someone that's so dear to you. You can't just turn your emotions off, but certainly after a period of time, it behooves you to continue to speak to them, to continue to encourage them, because don't you agree they can still not hear us audibly, but certainly sense our energy and the emotions coming from us?
Oh, absolutely. An attachment is an attachment. And unfortunately, what I've seen, and the reason I address this subject, is because of what I've witnessed around me and during my out-of-body experiences, where I see that some people are unfortunately held back from progressing. And people don't, a lot of people don't want to hear this, because they, but just grieving alone doesn't help the person who is past. That's for the individual who is missing the person. That may be helping the person that's alive to get over it, but we seldom think about the person that's past.
Right.
What's needed, I think, more is positive thoughts of, and now continue your journey. Now continue your journey into higher levels of reality, into higher levels of consciousness. You know, go to the, more than just go to the light, go to your higher self, go to your spiritual essence, go to have the highest spiritual experience you can possibly have. Unfortunately, a lot of this clinging is what it ends up being to a loved one, I have found, holds them more to the astral plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the only one. This has been said by in many other cultures, including the Buddhists. They talk about the people are held into the bardos by the clinginess. That's why the physical body, by the way, most people are unaware of this, but that's why the physical body is incinerated immediately at death in Hinduism and Buddhism.
That's right.
Because they want to break the attachment to matter. There's a reason for this. A lot of people say, oh, it's because they didn't have room or space or ground. No, that's not the case at all. India has lots of ground. It's because they want to break the attachment to the body,
yes,
physical body.
That's right.
Because they feel, and I agree with them, that attachment to physical matter slows the progress of soul. That's why the whole concept of destroying the physical body in funeral pyres become part of their long-established history, because it was a sensible way to break any attachment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's just the physical attachment, but they're also breaking that emotional. In other words, they feel all attachments to the individual, the all lingering attachments that may hold them back from progressing in the afterlife, should be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with them.
Mm-hmm. And yet we are taught, especially in Western society, not taught, but we adopt the feeling that we've got to do everything in our power to hold on to that loved one. Think about
yes.
it. That's exactly
yes.
what we're
and
taught.
It's the opposite, really.
Just the opposite. We
even though what people forget, I use the term that, you know, how many crosses do we need?
Right.
So if you believe in reincarnation, then people are still holding on to someone who died 20 years ago. They may have already incarnated, for God's sake.
Isn't that something?
We know. So, I mean, we have to look at the entire spectrum of life differently.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. Well, that's a good good segue to talk about reincarnation a little bit. In the book, you portray Frank as planning on reincarnating on the planet, and yet there's some schools of thought who feel that if you progress to a certain level and learn the lessons necessary in that spectrum, that reincarnating back into the physical world may not be necessary. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on that, because and I also on top of that, I want to ask you, where did Frank ultimately end up? Or am
well,
I? Is that a spoiler?
Well, in a way. let me address your first part of the
okay.
question. Number one, I think that people like Frank reincarnated, and I state this in the book, because he had a mission to accomplish. He had a specific mission. At the very last chapter, I disclose his mission was to assist other physical beings to help to accelerate their growth. That he had a mission to accomplish. In other words, he was going to teach them how to leave their bodies consciously. I go into some, it's not, in, I don't put it in depth, but it's very clear he has a mission to do. And I feel that many souls do reincarnate, even though they don't have to. A good example may be Buddha and Jesus and reality, but I thought they felt compassion possibly for those in the physical world and wanted to assist. And I think Frank was kind of along the same ilk. He reached a certain level of consciousness and he thought that he could assist. So he decided. That's my idea. Now what happens next is yet to be decided.
There you go. Enough said. Wow. Well, listen, if we haven't whet the audience's appetite at this point to read this fantastic book, I don't know what else will do it. I'm telling you, people, this is just an incredible read. I enjoyed it. I may actually read it again. I read What Dreams May Come probably 3 times, just to give you an idea. There's still so much ground to cover here. Again, such a brilliant illustration through this fictional character's eyes of the multitude of conditions, environments, habits that are carried also into the afterlife realms, plural. Let's talk about addictions and personal convictions as being carried into that realm, addictions in particular.
Yes, what I wanted to convey was the fact that many people, even today, feel that once you die, you become like some enlightened spirit, and that everything is done, your journey's over, and nothing could be further from the truth. We continue, just our same state of consciousness continues at death that we held during life. And in other words, the ignorant do not become enlightened, they remain ignorant, they're just in a different vibrational reality. And what I tried to portray throughout the book in his journey of, I had the character exploring many different consensus realities. Mm-hmm. And they're all, many of them, unfortunately, he runs into people that are addicted to all of the things. For instance, he runs into gambling halls, and he runs into other areas. People continue their obsessions. Because we're not mentally whitewashed of all of our issues. And this is one of the reasons, of course, why reincarnation is a reality, because that is the process that we use to cleanse. Anyway, many of the issues, as a matter of fact, all of the issues that we have with us, and a lot of people don't want to hear this because they rather believe that, oh, everybody's purified. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And we have to work on ourselves even after death.
Absolutely.
And that is the process that is just a flat-out reality that I've observed and others have observed in many, many, many instances. What's amazing is the way it develops, is that many of these obsessions get to be quite ingrained into people. And that's what I wanted to portray in the book, the fact how negative these experiences can be, because people essentially, let's look at people in the physical world. They run on automatic. They really do. People run on automatic. All of us do.
Mm-hmm.
We get up in the morning, we do the same kind of habit. Habits are ingrained. It's difficult to break a habit in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
Look how difficult it is to break, to stop smoking for people.
Yeah.
All physical habits have at their core a mental component that drives it, a compulsion, a need. And those mental elements and emotional elements are still present after death. That's what I wanted to get across.
Well, you did that beautifully. You really did. Wow. Let's talk about, briefly, we are winding down. We've got about 10 minutes left, maybe a little less. The pervasive power of group thought, pervasive into the afterlife, right?
Yes. Well, group thought is a very powerful, powerful process. I mean, you go into any church and you see the result of group thought. I mean, you go to a baseball game and you're observing group thought. I mean, people are all charged up and cheering their teams. It's all a collective of emotions and thought.
Mm-hmm.
And people really they're into it. I mean, people, in other words, group thought continues to be the dominant force that creates reality in the afterlife. Just like reality. And there's countless of these realities. In other words, the born-again Christians will create their own consensus realities. They're not going to be hanging out with Muslims.
Right.
In the afterlife. The Muslims will create, the right-wing Muslims will create their own consensus reality afterlife. The moderate Muslims would probably have their own.
Yeah.
In other words, group thought dominates because it's a collective, and collective thought is what molds energy forms
mm-hmm.
and what molds environments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I talk about there's millions and millions of these. And each one, which is I found strange, is that everybody thinks they're in heaven because to them, that is heaven.
Right.
But yeah. Actually, they're on the astral plane far away from what we would perceive as the higher or inner, higher vibrational levels of true spiritual reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's consensus thought dominates everything that people experience in their lives. Let's face it, why are people rooting their sports team?
Right.
It's because of consensus thought.
That's right. Which is
I don't do it. I find it. But the point is that people don't realize how they are. In other words, everybody's a product of their environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're molded by it.
Yeah. And it continues.
I mean, why is America? Why are most people in America Christian?
Right.
I mean, if we were born in India, we would not be Christian. If we were born in Iraq, we wouldn't be Christian, would we? It's all about the consensus reality that we enter.
Yeah, and it's a very stubborn reality, unrelenting.
Yeah, and people have a hard time breaking out. I call it breaking out of the box.
Breaking out of the box. Well, I like to say there is no box. Even more.
It's the only box there is what we create.
Exactly.
For
That's literally true. That is literally true. William, this has been amazing. You know, I'm looking at my phone. I am losing my battery because we were talking for so long before we started recording. We're going to have to wind down. This is a lot of stuff to chew on. Maybe it's even appropriate that we wind down now because I think it's absolutely important that people really contemplate what's going on here. Adventures in the Afterlife, where is it available?
It's available through Amazon.com, through my website, which is astralinfo.org.
Astralinfo.org. We will make sure to have that linked up on the website. Well, as always, I thank you so much for your wisdom and what you're sharing with millions of people. So much to really think about. Get this book, read it, and think, and then take action. There's a lot we can do. William, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
As controversial as this may be to some, William holds steadfast to his conviction that death is but a gateway to an infinite number of realities. The adventure only truly begins once we take our last conscious breath and awaken into a world that is beyond what we could possibly imagine while here in the physical body. I encourage you to pick up a copy of Adventures in the Afterlife, which can be found by visiting the links below. If you enjoyed this interview, you might want to check out my first interview with William Buhlmann from May of 2012. I thank you for listening to Conscious Inquiry. Until next time, I'm Alexis Brooks.